festivals, the feasts. No, He wants us to come daily. The Lord wants family. He wants intimacy every day, just like a parent wants that kind of relationship with their children and their grandchildren. That's all the Lord wants, is a family. And of course, we know there's an enemy out there, and he's out to destroy everything that has to do with God, His creation, and His people. And it's amazing how He has had giants throughout the history of the world, always to destroy this land, excuse me, and the people, because He doesn't like the plan of redemption. Is that the enemy? excuse me. Well, anyway, His plan is to deceive each one of us, to try to draw us away from the family of God. You know, I read in Revelation chapter 12, that Satan has a plan. He's out to deceive the entire world if he can. And we understand it clear back to Genesis chapter 3, how he did that with Eve and with Adam and Eve and the fall. He's out to do that, and he hasn't given up. It's still going to happen with, you know, I just can't figure out how you can live in a paradise, be in a perfect situation, no death, decay, and a person rebels against the Creator or against the person that created him. How's that possible? Which he happened to Satan and his followers, the fallen angels, and it happened again in a paradise with Adam and Eve. And the Bible says it's going to happen again. It's going to happen after the Lord returns and sets up His kingdom and binds the enemy for 1,000 years and then loses him. It says there's going to be people that deceived. How is that possible? That's why it's so important to stay close to your members of your friends, the congregation, to keep you strong, because there's going to be days when you don't feel like worshiping the Lord, and weeks because of challenges in our life. So the enemy's going to come. And there's a battle going on. I think we all realize there's a battle going on in the heavenlies, and it's out to destroy anything and everything that God has. I think back to a situation that happened to me in my senior year of high school. I got an invitation to go to listen to the President of the United States, who was John F. Kennedy at that time. And it was a pretty amazing occasion, and my friend in school's dad worked at the place where John F. Kennedy was coming to speak. So he was able to get us inside there if we would stand in the back and listen to him. So we went first to the airport, of the Dallas airport, and it was so crowded that we left and went to the corner and stood on the corner, so that when the president's motorcade came by, we were the only ones there, and so we were waving at him and taking pictures. And it was very exciting to see the President of the United States, probably kind of like the Pope coming here, to be able to just say, wow, this man has influence in the world. And then we went straight to the place where he was to speak. And we were waiting upstairs, looking out the window, waiting for the motorcade to come. And while we were there, all of a sudden I listened to the security officer that I was standing nearby, and it says, the president has been hit by a rock and we're taking him to the hospital. And the hospital was right beside where we were. And of course, the whole story is he was shot and killed instantly. So I'm thinking, wow, hit by the rock? Whoa, what does that mean? And all of a sudden we see the motorcade coming right there in front of us, and here's the president in there. We didn't know what had happened. And instead of slowing down, he goes right by us to the hospital right next door. I said, come on, let's go. So we got in our little vehicle and went, pulled into a construction area where they were building a new wing of the hospital. And we jumped out and went in before they could seal off the hospital from anybody coming in, and went upstairs and found out the floor of the medical area where they bring in emergencies, and stood there. And within a few moments, a lady comes out and looks at us. There were three of us. And she says, and she's standing about to where those chairs are. And she says, "Do any of you boys have blood for the president?" You know, I was just a senior in high school. I didn't even know what kind of blood I had. And we just kind of said, you know, didn't really say anything. No, no. And she turns around, walks off. And then within 10 minutes, a priest walks out and says, "The president has been the president is expired. And we're just saying, "What?" You know, we're just young people, don't have a clue what's going on, but we can't believe it. So we kind of leave, and then we head back to my high school. And when we get to the high school, the street on my high school, here is an ambulance, and a few of the officers, a few policemen around there, and we stop, and I get out and say, "What happened here?" And they were putting this body into the ambulance, and they said, and I said to a lady that was watching the whole thing, she said, "You know, there was a fellow walking along here, and all of a sudden, a police drives up, stops him, and asks him a question, and he just pulls out a gun and kills him right there." And I, of course, I didn't know what was going on. This was one block from our high school. And come to find out, it was Lee Harvey Oswald, the person that killed the president as well as this man. And I just sat there, you know, what in the world is going on? Then something happened. For the next few years, I began to do my evangelism or my witnessing to people. Say, I would tell them about this story, and it catches everybody's attention. And then I'd say, "You know, what would happen to you if you suddenly were killed or died one night? Where would you spend eternity?" Catches their attention, doesn't it? You know, they're all drawn into the story. And it just says, wow. Because I don't think John F. Kennedy realized that was his last day. Then something amazing happened to me. Ginger and I, my wife, we went on a history of the church or the whole Christianity. In other words, our roots of America. Why are we so religious in America? And so we visited all the places of the early believers in the United States. And it was an amazing trip. But while we were in New York City, we had the evening off, and my wife says, "Let's go to a musical." I said, "Okay." So she gets us tickets, but she gets an opportunity to go on a TV program for the day, for that evening. So she says, "I'm going to be late." And I says, "Okay." So I went to the musical, and I watched the first half of it. Then the intermission came, and then my wife comes, and we get to watch the last 45 minutes or so of the musical. But here's what's interesting. The whole time for that last 45 minutes, well, who's that? Well, what's that? I had to sit there and explain every person how they fits into the picture, because she couldn't figure out anything. You know, a few years ago at our little Bible school, I was teaching a class on creation science. And I loved it. It's my passion. And then one day, one of our faculty members said, "Dennis, your class must be required for all of the students." And I said, "I don't want all of the students. I only want those that have an interest in creation," which was 50 to 100 students. "No, you have to teach all of the people." Why? Because this generation doesn't know who God is. The young people are grown up in a pagan society. I had prayer and Bible reading every morning in our public school, growing all the way up through high school. But that left shortly after I graduated back in the 60s. No more prayer, no more Bible reading. So young people growing up, they have no foundation of the Bible. Everybody used to know. When you start talking about John 3:16, they knew what you were talking about. But today, they don't even know who God is. They don't know His rules, His punishment. They don't know anything. So this faculty member said, "Dennis, your class has to be for all of the students." And I says, but I only want those that really have an interest. No, they won't understand the whole Bible if they don't have a foundation. In other words, if a young person does not understand the origins, where they came from, they're not going to understand their identity, who they are made in the image of God. And if they don't understand their identity, they're not going to understand their purpose for being created. If they don't understand their purpose for being created, they're not going to understand the responsibilities that God requires us. If they don't understand their responsibilities, their purpose, their identity, they won't have a clue about the destiny, heaven or hell. So I begin to see the importance for this generation of young people. They've got to have an understanding, the foundational basis for why they believe that God is the Creator. In fact, the most important and the most amazing miracle in the entire Bible is Genesis 1:1. You may think it's a resurrection or something else. Yeah, that's pretty important. But if you don't understand that God is able to create the entire universe out of absolutely nothing because He's all-powerful, all-knowing, He's everywhere. If you don't believe that, and there's no way you can test it from a scientific, rational point of view, you have to accept it. But what's neat about our God is He doesn't expect us to have blind faith. He gives us reasons for this revelation. And once you have reasons and understand from a logical standpoint why this is the Word of God, then it's easy to believe any of the other miracles. I just was reading just before I came up here. I was looking at a little passage because one of the favorite areas that young people, that big people, that little kids love is dinosaurs. Anybody like dinosaurs? Those big, terrible monsters that will eat you alive. Well, what does the Bible say about dinosaurs? You're not going to find the word dinosaur in the Bible because why? It is based on two Greek words, relatively new world. Dinosaur means terrible lizard. Do we have any terrible lizards today? Yeah, the crocodile, alligator. Okay. So, here's what's interesting. Does the Bible actually say anything about terrible lizards? Well, there's a couple passages over in the book of Job, which is written after the flood of Noah's day, about behemoth, this gigantic creature. And they've just found a new one, a new set of bones, I understand, down in South America. That's the biggest one ever. It's like 10, 12 stories tall when it stands up. Can you imagine a creature walking down the road 10 or 12 stories tall? That's why we love dinosaurs. That's why children love dinosaurs. That's why Satan goes after the children to try to indoctrinate them against the Bible, against the Creator. And I'm reading in here about that passage, and it says, and of course, from an evolutionary standpoint, who influences us and influenced the scholars to translate certain passages in the Bible from an evolutionary standpoint, they said, this guy must have been something like an elephant. You know, if you read in the footnotes of some of the Bibles and some of the commentaries, behemoth, this fella in Job chapter 39? He is an elephant or something like a hippopotamus. Have you ever seen the tail of a hippopotamus or an elephant? It's like a little noodle, a little wet noodle. But this is talking like a cedar tree. And if you've ever seen the pictures of those gigantic behemoths back in the days of the dinosaurs, those were like cedars dragged along the back of their behinds. Okay? Now, the next chapter is even more amazing. This Bible says Leviathan was an alligator. How in the world can you come up with an alligator? In other words, here's a little fella. I don't know if you've ever watched on some of those programs on television what you can do with an alligator. I mean, they come up here and they stick their heads inside the mouth of these big, huge things. I mean, if they go like that, that guy's dead. In fact, I watched this big power team fella You know, one of these big wrestlers? They talked him up to come on up here. They showed him what to do, and everybody's watching. And so he sticks his head in here. Bam! I mean, it closed right on his head. And they said they it was being filmed, and everybody jumped up and went up to help him. Now, he's huge. And the alligator's pretty good size, but you can't open the mouth. You can keep them closed, but once they're closed, you can't open them. So they had crowbars and everything and a whole bunch of people pulling that thing out, and they finally did. But he had a nice set of alligator tracks across his side of his head. Didn't kill him, but it shows you something. You can be foolish. These guys are not to be playing with. But nevertheless, it says it's an alligator. But what catches my attention is I've never seen an alligator breathe fire. If you read that passage, it says he's breathing fire. How in the world can a creature breathe fire? And of course, that's why they change it to an alligator. But that still doesn't make sense. But here's what they say. He wasn't actually breathing fire. And it actually says that he is out there in the water in a morning when the sun is coming through. And there's a lot of maybe misty fog blowing up there. And the sun hits it just right. And when he opens his mouth, if you're looking at it, it kind of looks like, you know, the sun is just beating on that. It looks like a flash of light or a flash of fire. And it's not really fire. Can God make a creature that breathes fire? If he can create everything out of nothing, is it possible that he knows how to make a little animal that can breathe fire? Or is that just fantasy, fictitious, or could it be actually a case? Did you know, here's a couple of little examples. When I was working in a country, the Caribbean, one summer, one night it was totally dark. I didn't have a flashlight, but I read the 23rd Psalm totally, totally, at night without any flashlight and without any moon or the stars, no lights at all. How did I do it? I picked up a little creature about this big, squeezed off his tail, and then read it, a lightning bug. Read the whole thing with just this little tiny creature. It has two chemicals that mixes together and produces like an artificial light, like you've seen on some of these little necklaces that they make, that if you just kind of crack it, the chemicals come together, and the little children can wear these necklaces and they glow in the dark. It's not hard. You know, there's another creature that, well, I watched this. I have a video of this little creature getting involved in a little fight, a little war with a crocodile. Crocodile went down there to have lunch, but he didn't realize that this was the wrong fellow to meet with. And the fight was over almost instantly. I mean, within just a couple of seconds. And the alligator went into convulsions almost instantly and shook for like a minute or 2 minutes. They just kept filming it. And the thing is shaking violently and trying to climb out of the water. And finally he does. He gets out and he just lays there. Big old alligator. Guess what it was? Just a little bitty electric eel. I don't know if you know much about an electric eel, but they can kill a human being. They can stun a giant horse. It's like, go over here and stick your finger in the electric socket and see what it feels like. That's what happens. The Lord has simply made this and designed this creature with a couple of chemicals. And all I have to do is mix those chemicals and it produces an electric shock. Is God able to do that? There's one other little creature that's very interesting. And you probably heard of this little creature. And I've seen it. It's just very small. But you've seen frogs, how they gulp, you know, the little tongue comes out and goes back in and picks up a little creature across there and just swallows it. Well, I watched on this one. He's picked this thing up, pulls back. He never closes his mouth. The bug is just hanging on this mouth. And it's wiggling its feet and finally wiggles loose off of the tongue and just walks away. And the frog never closes its mouth. I've watched army ants. Army ants, I've seen and I've read stories of them, how if you tie up your sheep or a pig, those army ants will just come up there and devour that thing that's tied up in certain places of Africa. Well, this little creature, as it's walking through the army ants, and yet if you've seen army ants, there's any small little creatures, they just devour. They just come up and they just tear it apart and carry it off. This little creature, when it came in, the army ants absolutely like the Red Sea, just parted. And it just walked right on through. Never bother. You ever heard of the bombardier beetle? It has two little twin tailpipes that rotate 360 degrees, and it fires like a machine gun. I forget how many per second. It's amazing. They have to slow it down very slow to be able to even see it firing, but it shoots out. It mixes two chemicals and causes an explosion. You can actually see the smoke coming out. It comes out at 100 degrees centigrade. The explosion, 100 degrees centigrade. Now, it's very small. You can feel it. You know, I've seen scientists, they irritate it so it will fire off, and you feel it. It's a little sting, but it's nothing that it will hurt a human. But is God able, if he's able to do that, is he able to make a big creature? Well, we don't have those big creatures necessarily anymore. But the Bible says there's a creature that once lived, not an alligator, but Leviathan. We don't know exactly what that creature was, but apparently God could do it. Now, that's what the evolutionary community will do to indoctrinate evolution into young people's minds, to say this is nothing but a book of stories and fables. I want to give you just five real quick principles. What time do we finish here? This is my hobby, so I'll keep you here all afternoon. I'll give you five. In other words, the battle that we are facing among the evolutionary community is, we are told that it is faith against science. No, it's not faith against science. It's faith against faith. And we'll see that pretty quick. I'm going to show you five fundamental fallacies with the faith of evolution. Very quickly. Spontaneous universe is the first one. In the beginning, there was absolutely nothing, and absolutely nothing exploded for no reason at all, and became absolutely everything for no reason at all. Is that science? Not at all. There's no way you can test that in a science laboratory. You have to accept that by faith. Now, why would an evolutionist or a non-believer choose that it happens by random chance and processes and over against a God who is a designer and a creator? Why would he choose that? I'll tell you in a moment. The second fallacy is spontaneous life. The first one was spontaneous universe. This one's spontaneous life. Life made itself. There were some molecules floating around after the initial explosion. And by chance and random processes, those little molecules floating around throughout the universe arranged themselves in self-replicating little bits of matter. They begin to duplicate themselves, and poof, one day they became the first living cell. Is there any way that you can test that in a laboratory? Not at all. It never has been. They've been working on trying to produce life from the chemicals that they think the chemicals were like during, you know, billions of years ago. And they started back in the 60s. Now they've been going over 50 years, and they still have never been able to produce a little one-cell creature by simply trying to make it happen through electrical zaps on chemicals. No, it's a faith. Why would you choose to believe that over God creating life? And then, number three, you know, here's what's interesting as I think about it on this number two. Life has never been able to be proven to take place in a laboratory, but it happened out there with no reason at all. And here is for 50, 60 years, an intelligent mind has been trying to do it, and they can't do it. But yet they said it happened out here with no intelligence whatsoever. What kind of science is that? So now there is a new kind of a direction to that probably we were visited by intelligent aliens that came to planet Earth, left some garbage or planted something that caused life to happen and begin to slowly change into all the other creatures. An alien. Can you prove that? No, that's not science. That's science fiction, if anything. So we have spontaneous universe, spontaneous life. Life made itself. And then, and they say it must be true because we know there's no God. And the atheists, you know, they say there is absolutely no God, and they hate Him. Think about that. They hate what does not exist. You can see it's not a problem up here. It's a problem right here. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Oh, the third one is spontaneous assent. That means slowly this one cell became the two cell, the three cell, the four cell, the multicell, and eventually the fish, the amphibian, finally it crawled out, you know, on land and became a little creature, a reptile, and a reptile became a bird, and a bird became a mammal, and a mammal became man. There's no proof of those gaps. I mean, there's no proof of that ascent up the ladder of life, the trees, you know, with all of the branches out. No proof of that. In fact, in the record of the rocks, it's got gaps between each species. Yeah, there's variety within each species, but not the transfer of one species turning into the next species. I think of man. What is man? From an evolutionary worldview, he's nothing more than three things: time plus matter plus chance. You and I are no different from a little mosquito, because the only difference between us and a mosquito is time and complexity. We came a little later after the mosquito, and we're much more complex than the mosquito. But man is a product of evolution, and if that's true, then time, millions of years ago, plus matter, atoms floating around, came together, combined, and by chance and random processes, he became the first living cell, and then eventually became us. What does that mean? That means a lot of things. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But think about that. This little tiny mosquito beats its wings 1,000 times per second. Did you hear what I just said? You can look it up on the internet. How does a little creature like that, that we would smash in a second, be created with some sort of a mechanism that causes it to beat its wings? You hear it, and we kill it in a second. But it was created for something. We don't know what it was created for. But my point is spontaneous ascent, it doesn't happen. There's no way to test it. Mutations plus naturalist selection is what we are told happens from one creature to the next creature. Mutations, these little tiny changes within our genes. And because of those changes and natural selection, the best survives, the strongest survives. Number four, we've talked about spontaneous universe, spontaneous life, spontaneous ascent. The fourth one, spontaneous logic. Logic is an abstract word. How do molecules suddenly begin to think? And suddenly begin to come up with truth? They're abstract terms. Atoms, chance, random processes, you get life and logic and truth. We have a reason for logic. The Bible says in John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word. What is the word in Greek? Logos, Where do we get our word logic from? Logos. And the Logos was with God, it says. And the Logos created everything. We have a reason for logic and truth. But the evolutionary community has no reason for truth, for logic. And the fifth one, spontaneous morality. It is not good. Have you ever heard somebody say, the Bible is not good? It slaughters innocent children. Commands the Israelites to slaughter. Isn't that terrible? Slaughter? It's evil? How do you come up with morality from an evolutionary standpoint? How do you come up with absolutes? It's absolutely wrong, we know, to torture little babies. How from an evolutionary standpoint, how do we determine what is absolutely right and absolutely wrong? There's no reason from an evolutionary. All we have is electrical impulses, we are told, that causes us to do this and not to do that. Electrical impulses from an evolutionary perspective. Is that the way we decide what is moral and what is not? If that is true, that evolution is true, we're just molecules in motion. And we simply react to these little electrical impulses. There's no reason for right and wrong. Slavery is not wrong. It's just my opinion that I don't want like slavery and you do. Or I like slavery and you don't. Or racism. It's just an opinion. If you do not have a standard by which to determine absolutes, it's just my opinion against your opinion. And it bases down to the survival of the fittest. Whoever is the strongest, whoever can get the largest group to determine that something is wrong, and we will kill you if you don't agree with us. That's morality. We don't get upset when we see out in Africa a lion kill an antelope. We don't go out there and say, you're on your way to jail. We don't even get upset if a lion kills another lion. That's just the way it is with animals. But aren't we all animals from an evolutionary standpoint? How do we determine that it's wrong to kill and murder another person and we will throw them into prison? See that? Spontaneous morality doesn't make sense from an evolutionary standpoint. Atoms, random processes, chance, time equals morality. Not a chance. We don't get upset when we mix vinegar with baking soda and there's a cloud. We don't take it immediately and discard it. No, we know it. Chemicals, that's the way they operate. If we are just chemicals that came up from pond scum, you know, we started in a pond and then little by little we became what we are. We're just chemicals. So it's just if I don't like that person and I just kill them, what's wrong with that? Animals kill each other. It's just natural. We're just saying it's wrong for Hitler to kill 6 million Jews. It's just an opinion. If you don't have a standard for what is right and wrong. You understand what I'm saying? You can't have this idea that life just arose by chance and morality somehow came about. No, it just doesn't happen that way. That's five absolutes. It makes no sense from an evolutionary worldview to have morality. In other words, what I'm saying is morality does not arise from biological processes. Let me say that again. Morality does not arise from biological processes. And what I found from the evolutionary worldview is that evolutionists borrow from the Bible. Evolutionists borrow morality. What do I mean by that? When it comes to saying, I believe there is some sort of a God out there because the scientists are seeing design like they've never seen design before. Let me give you some examples of this. I think of the story of a little situation that happened years ago. I was watching television, and I watched a program called, what was the name of it? That's Incredible. Anybody ever heard of that program? They had amazing stories on there, and one of them was about this school in a little town called Glen Burnie, Maryland, of a school that goes and raises funds for the children for different projects, and the children go out and sell tickets, and the people that buy these tickets write their name on it, and then the children bring them back, and they tie them to strings of balloons filled with helium. And every year, on a given date, they release 5,000 to 7,000 of these helium-filled balloons. And these balloons drift off. And on it, it says, if you find this balloon and you are the furthest person away from this school, if you notify us, you could win first prize if you're the furthest person. So every year, they let these balloons loose. And usually, the winner is not more than 10 to 15 miles away. But on this occasion, one of the balloons began to drift, and it drifted 50 miles, 75 miles, 100 miles, which is what, 150 kilometers? So it went into a neighboring state in a little town, and the balloon descended back once the helium dissipated through the walls of the balloon. It comes back to the earth. And here is a guy working in his yard, and he sees a balloon coming down, and he notices a little paper tied to it, and it lands on his roof. So he gets a ladder and goes up there and looks at it. And he looks at this. Oh, wow. And his wife is out there in the yard. Hun, look at this. What is it? I got this balloon. Oh, really? Yeah, but it's got my name on it. His name was Richard Henry Lee. Now, Richard Henry Lee was the fathers of America that signed our Declaration of Independence back in the 1700s. The school where these balloons are released from was Richard Henry Lee. This man had the exact same name as that school. Not only that, he was a direct descendant of the original Richard Henry Lee. In fact, he was the only man in his entire state that had the name of Richard Henry Lee. And then the host on the program says, that's incredible. You know, that's the end of the story. And I was thinking about that a week or two later in my little devotional time, and I heard the Holy Spirit say, Dennis, did you know I can guide every atom in the entire universe? I created every atom. I have control over every atom. The only problem I have is with people who will not allow me and not invite me to help to guide them. And the more that we ask the Lord to guide us, I don't know how He does it, but I ask Him every day for divine appointments. Every day I ask Him that. I got so many stories because I journal these things. They're amazing. Is the Lord able to do that? If He created the entire universe, is He able to guide us, His children? Don't we like to do that with our children, especially very obedient children? We'll guide them, not in a dictatorial way, but we'll guide them because it's for their good. And I think about that little story of that. Yes, the Lord's able to do that. And I could tell you story after story about birds and the migration and how the Lord does that. I told one the other night, Pacific golden plover. It winters in our state of Hawaii out in the Pacific Ocean. And then it flies back to Alaska, the state of Alaska, where it lays its eggs and raises its young. Flies back and forth. It takes about 3 or 4 days to make the flight, and it flies it nonstop. But it only takes about 70 hours of fuel in his little tiny body. He's about the size of a pigeon. 70 hours, but the flight takes 90 hours. How does he make up the extra 20 hours? God has programmed a little tiny bit of information in his little tiny brain that's about the size of this. It says fly in V formation. Because V formation helps you to save fuel. You've seen the different flocks of birds that come probably every year across Israel. and some of them are flying in V formation. That lead bird cuts the draft and causes the birds behind to save energy. And usually when this bird gets tired, he'll drop to the back. The next one will take the lead. But over the course, they make up the 20 hours of extra fuel that they need. And plus, they end up with an extra 10 hours of fuel, body fat. So in case they hit strong contrary winds, they'll still make it to the destination. But the amazing thing about that is the little tiny offspring, the little tiny birds that the parents were raising back in the state of Alaska don't fly with the parents. They're not big enough. They have to wait two or three or four more weeks before they're strong enough to make the journey. But on a given day, those little young birds fly together, V formation, and they make it. But how do they know where to go? Because it's about, what, 3,000 to 4,000 miles, which is, what, 6,000 kilometers? How do they make it? How do they know where to go? If they're off even a fraction of a degree on the compass, they'll miss it by several hundred miles. And if they're trying to figure out where to how to catch it, they'll run out of fuel. And they don't swim. They don't eat along the way. Is God able to do that? Absolutely. Can God do that with us? Absolutely. All he wants is a family. All he wants is intimacy. But unfortunately, people that don't want him, the reason they don't want him is because they want to be king. And we all want to be king. Ever since we're born and raised by our parents, we let the parents know we want to be king. Little by little, the parents have to train us. And if they train us properly and instruct us about obedience, then we become humble. But there's so many big people, scientists, who say, absolutely not. Even though they see these amazing creatures. For example, have you ever heard of the little gecko that climbs around on the ceiling and down the side? How does it do that? It can walk on glass. It can walk on any type of materials. How does this little gecko do that? I mean, can we do that? Well, they've studied the feet of that little gecko, and it has little bristles like toothbrush bristles on the toothbrush. It only has a half a billion, 500 million. 500 little tiny bristles, but it doesn't use oil or suction cups when it's walking along the ceiling. It uses what is called molecular attraction. What is that? Magnetism. It has little tiny atoms in its feet. It has little atoms all across the ceiling. And those atoms have a plus and a minus. And you know, when you put a plus and a minus together, it attracts each other. How did the Lord do that? That's amazing, God, that we serve. He's able to do these things. And there's another little creature that's even smaller. Well, what was the one I wanted to tell? Do you remember? Let's see if I've written it down here. You got to hear some of these. There's a couple I just want to tell you. Oh, my. Well, okay. Yeah, the pistol shrimp. Anybody ever heard of this little shrimp that lives in the ocean called a pistol shrimp? He has a gun. No, a claw, you know, a claw that comes out and like that, and it'll pinch you. But it has a gun in that claw. And it fires at some little creature going by that it wants to have lunch. You know, eat it. He shoots it. It comes out at 60 miles an hour. That is what? 90 kilometers an hour? 100 kilometers an hour? It shoots 100 kilometers an hour. And what's interesting is it comes out at 212 decimal. In other words, the loud. I don't know what the speaker is right now. Anybody have an idea? Any of you technicians? What am I speaking at? 60 maybe? Decimal points. But what's interesting about this little... Well, a jet engine is 140. A firecracker or a gun is like 140 decimals. But this little creature comes out at 212. When it fires a gun, 212 decimals? And in fact, they've shown it You know, it shoots this out and it stuns the creature. Then he goes over and just gobbles it down. How the Lord could make a little creature like that? Just beyond our imagination. Here's another one. It's called the bacterium flagellum. The bacterium flagellum is a little tiny creature that lives in the liquids, you know, water. It has an interesting, it's just one cell. How big are they? Well, if you take a human hair, you can get 8 million of them in the diameter of a human hair. Side by side, 8 million of these little creatures. So we're talking about, they're very tiny, okay? But they have a tail, and that tail is the propeller which propels them through the water. Now, the scientists have studied this little tiny tail. It's just like an outboard motor. And they checked out the parts. They go in with an electron microscope, and they look that it has about 20, 25 little parts that have to be perfectly assembled in order. If there's one that's not there or one in the wrong place, it doesn't survive. That tells us there's a design in it, and we all know that when there's design, there's got to be a designer. The amazing thing is the little propeller. It swings 100,000 times per minute. How does something that tiny spin at 100,000 times per minute? And if it wants to stop and go in a different direction, it can stop instantly and turn that thing the opposite direction. 100,000 times per minute is 1,600 times per second. 1,600 times per second is going around. How does it do that? That's our God. Our God is an amazing God. If you believe in the first verse of the Bible that in the beginning God created everything out of absolutely nothing, you'll have no problem with the rest of Scripture. But I'm telling you, God doesn't leave Revelation without giving us reason for believing that this is true. For example, I like this one. Everybody knows about when God spoke to Moses and said, "Go tell Pharaoh to let my people go." And what did Moses say back to God? "Are you kidding? You think Pharaoh's going to listen to me? Who am I? Take my message and take my miracle, my supernatural. Take that rod. I will do something that will get his attention and let him know that the message I'm sending him is from me, from God." You know, God does that with us. He wants us to obey him. When he gives us a message and says, "I want you to do this," he doesn't ask us blindly. He gives us good reasons to believe. But unfortunately, the evolutionary community doesn't like all of these proofs that there is a God. Why? Because they want to remain to be God. They don't like anybody saying, "I want you to follow my rules." They want to make their own rules. They borrow from the rules that they like to live by and discard the ones that they don't like. And they don't like the idea of any threat of eternal punishment. So all of the scientists that believe, yes, there must be a designer out there, they don't believe that the God of the Bible is the designer. They've got to say there's an alien out there, some force out there, because they don't like to be accountable to the God of the Bible, let alone any idea that there might be some punishment that goes along if I don't obey. So that's the bottom line. Why? People choose to believe the faith of the five areas that I just spoke about: spontaneous universe, spontaneous life, spontaneous ascent, spontaneous logic, and spontaneous morality. They'll choose not to believe in anything that's logical, but they'll choose to believe those ridiculous ideas simply because they get to remain to be God of their lives. That's the bottom line. It's faith. It's faith against faith. It's not faith against science when they say that the Bible is faith and evolution is science. No, it's faith against faith. And one has good science and the other is bad science. The evidence, and I'll close with this, the evidence that we have to confirm something to be true or not doesn't tell us anything. It really depends upon the scientists to tell us and he interprets it based on his worldview. If his worldview is based on the Bible, he's going to give a different opinion than an evolutionist who has a worldview that there is no Bible, there is no God. He will interpret the exact same evidence. And that's why often you say, how can one science disagree with the other when they have the same evidence? It's based on the worldview. So understand, in the last days, there's going to be deception that comes along. And Satan is out to get you. You may not even have an interest in the area of science, but the enemy is going to come and get you one way or another because he's after every one of us. He hates anything to do with God. He wants you to be one of his followers. And so he's out to destroy the whole plan of redemption. Anything to do that God has created, he wants to destroy. So be encouraged. God will give you plenty of reason to believe in this revelation. Amen.